Welcome to Rise Up Ministries Mississippi Podcast. Join us for a dynamic journey of faith and community. I'm John Kahn, and on this podcast, we'll share inspiring sermons, discuss our spiritual walks, provide biblical counseling insights, and feature uplifting community interviews. From deep dives into scripture to practical advice for navigating life's challenges, we're here to support you on your path. Subscribe now, and let's rise together with Rise Up Ministries Mississippi.
That was me trying to do a video. God did not give me the ability to speak very well, so I'm going to struggle through this, so y'all bear with me. And that was, well, all I was trying to do was say my name was Dusty Snyder, and I couldn't get it out. And I'm with I was supposed to say I'm Dusty Snyder, and I'm with Crossroads, and I could not remember that line. But, yeah, first of all, I want to commend our worship. You have a very beautiful spirit up here. You need to keep pursuing that. Just keep practicing, and you're going to get better. But it was awesome. Anyways, and John's been he's going to be in my story, but he's always meant a lot to me. It's been 6 years since I've been 5 years sober. I kind of went back out there after. You must not have been that good of a counselor. No, he really was, because that's why I still keep up with him and stay in touch. And when I have difficult questions or I need somebody smarter than me to help me guide these guys, I always call on John. And so anyways, I'm going to start this off, and y'all going to bear with me starting off, because it's always hard for me to get started. Well, I grew up in a divorced family. My parents divorced when I was, my name is Dusty Snyder, and I'm from Columbus, Mississippi. I grew up in a divorced family. They divorced when I was 3, but my parents always did a good job of staying involved. And I seen my dad was involved in my life, so that really wasn't much of a factor. But at a young age, I started playing baseball, and I was pretty good at it. And that's what I found my identity in growing up, from the time I was 5 to I was 20-something years old. And that's what I found. I was in and out of church growing up, but this wasn't made to go every day. Baseball tournaments were more important. So, and I was always one of the better players on the team, so everybody wanted me there. I felt a connection. I could make good plays, and I could do all this stuff, and just got all this attention, and I loved it, you know. And anyways, if life went on, I found my identity in partying, being the life of the party. That's what girls and partying was the scene I was on. And when I was 16 years old, I had a sports injury where I broke my hip, and that's where I got prescribed to Lortabs. So that's where my addiction started when I was 16, and it started off as prescribed, and before I knew what addicted was, I was addicted. So, I'm going to jump up a little, but I wrote an outline of my story here, and I've been to prison 5 times, and I forgot to put that on my notes, so I guess I just want to try to forget that part of my life. But anyways, I'm getting to it. So, yeah, I need that. It's bad if you could tell I need something to drink. No, I'm good. Yeah, I'm sweating. Anyways, when I get to the easy part, I'll settle in. So that's how my addiction started, and spent most of my 20s and 30s in addiction. 27 years old when I first got arrested, and I was running a fraudulent prescription ring that I got caught up in. Because I started taking the pills. I first just started taking them, then I started snorting them, then I started IV using them, and prescription would run out, so I'd chase them on the street. Just the same old story with addiction, with prescription pills. Anyway, so like I said, I got arrested when I was 27 for the first time. Started going to prison. I had a sweet plea deal because they gave me 20 years at first for a conspiracy to commit fraudulent prescription. They knocked it down to 5 years, and I said to do 1 year in a county jail. Well, it wasn't, and I could be a trustee the whole time. So I get double double trays, and I get to go out to work. It's really not even like being locked up too much. You just go back to jail and sleep at night. But it wasn't 3 months in, and I screwed that up. I was bringing drugs into the jail and selling them there and still doing my drugs there. So they sentenced me to prison. This time I got my whole 5 years back. That's when I started my stints going to prison. Did my first stint, and I did 13 months. Like I came home for, that time I came home for a year, and I violated and went back, came back home, and it wasn't like a week, and I violated and went back. And then the next time I came home, it was so funny. This is a funny story. It don't happen often. Like in this big prison, I was in a quick bed, and they assign you your bunk. I went home, violated, went to the county jail, got sent back to prison so quick, they gave me the same bunk back. they ain't had time to get my bunk away. So anyways, I couldn't quit for nothing, man. I wanted to, I tried everything I could, and it wasn't happening, you know. And towards the end, I started doing meth about the last year, and I started doing meth and pills together and heroin and OD two or three times. One time I woke up and tried to take. I was surrounded by police, and when I went to sleep, I wasn't. And I woke up and I had six police around me. I was trying to get on down. They was like, "Calm down, Dusty. Calm down. We're here to help." I was like, "That's the first time." But anyways. So at the end of the time, I started doing the meth and started stealing from different Walmarts and stuff like that to help with the habit. And then I ran out of friends, couches to stay on, had nowhere to sleep. Nobody wanted me around. I remember the last few days I was walking down our main streets, 45, and, walking to Dollar General, steal me a charger, go to the Texaco and charge my phone up, and get kicked out of there and have to go somewhere to get some cool air for a minute. Y'all know how, well, the people that's been in the streets know how that is. Started raining that night. I was sleeping outside. Had to get under the Carl Hogan sign where I wouldn't get wet and I'd get a good night's sleep. Sleeping in the ditch. And right before, I have a cousin of mine that adored me, thought I hung the moon, and I could always count on him for a $100 bill and a cold shower, you know. But when I went up to his house, and he just looked at me, and he wouldn't let me come in. I said, "Well, can I get a Diet Coke at least?" And he said no, and slammed the door in my face. And my mom cut me off at this time too, so I knew I must be doing something wrong. And this is when I go to the Pines in 2000. I think it's 2017, 17, 18. And that's where I meet John, and he's my counselor, and I get on the right track, and I'm doing good for around 9 months. And my lovely wife here, you can stand up and wave. Now she's shy too. But anyways, I've skipped a lot, and I knew I was going to. But we were dating for 2 or 3 years at that point, and. She was still in addiction. I was getting out. I was out of it. I was sober for about 9 months. And anyways, we had some. All right, there's a confusion in the relationship. So, and she got pregnant with our first kid, and Ooh, help me out here, Lord. We had our first kid, and he only lived 15 days. And he had MRSA. His brain was swelling. It gets me every time. Anyways, so I with the confusion in the relationship, not knowing if it was mine or somebody else, you know how it is when you're in addiction. I tried not to make a decision on what to do with the kid because of that, but I always had. In the back of my mind, that it may have played a factor, because we had to decide. His lungs kept popping, and we had to keep putting the chest tubes in, and finally put the third one in. And if we got his lungs back, we still had the brain issue. We didn't know what kind of life he'd be able to live, and so we decided that he. We decided he fought long enough, and we sent him home with Jesus. And that ultimately sent me back out there, because I wasn't sure if we made the right decision. Well, God wanted to let me know that he did, because I caught this infection called endocarditis from my IV drug use, and it sent me to have open heart surgery by the time I was 35 years old. I had the chest tubes. I had MRSA in my entire body, just like he did. And it was so much pain that a weight of a sheet was too much for me to bear. I was too weak to hold up a plastic spoon, too weak to talk. I could barely write. I was trying to tell, I could really do is point, and I'd get my parents and Brooke. I'd get out. All I could do was point when I wanted something, and I thought it was pretty simple what I wanted. But they touched 30 things. It would be the one thing I didn't want, and I'd get aggravated. But anyways, so that let me know that there was no infant child needed to go through that pain. So we definitely made the right decision. So, and this in my first surgery, when I went into the behavioral health, get checked in, my heart rate was up to 250 and climbing. The doctors come rushing in. They're like, they start doing some tests and stuff, and they're like, man, this child's sick. We got to get him to ICU. And that's when I went in to ICU and find out that, like I said, I had the MRSA in my tricuspid valve, and it was pumping infection through my entire body. And This was the most, up to surgery was the most painful and the hardest. They tried everything they could do, and I don't know if you saw my legs right here, all my blood capillaries were popping, and my toenails, I got them right there, they're really long too, gosh dog, but they started falling off, and my platelets, your platelets have to be a count of 50,000 in order for them to clot. And mine was at 17,000 and falling. And the doctors at this point have done everything they knew to do. And they told my mom and my family to tell your son goodbye. I mean, could you imagine what I put my mom and my wife and all them through having to, I mean, they thought I was dead. I mean, because I had to have surgery by in the morning, and my platelets were falling, and with no sign of them going back up. They've tried everything. And then all of a sudden, so my parents come in there. I don't remember this because I was out of it, but they tell me goodbye and all this stuff. They told me, they said all that. It was sad. And then right before surgery, right before I had to have surgery, I was going to die, my platelets jump up to over 50,000. And the nurses come running in and take me back to surgery. And they said when they opened me up that my insides was just mush. And they stopped right then and said a prayer over my body, because they didn't think it was possible that I would make it through it. And but I did, as you can see. And all the nurses and doctors all tell me that there's no scientific reason that I made it through it, that I'm still here. But, you know, we all know the reason. That's Jesus Christ. Anyways, After that surgery, I had a 3-month long rehab, you'd call it, where I was on these high octane antibiotics, is what I called them. Because they just went there and repaired my valve, and they had me on these antibiotics to make sure everything was cleared out. And at that time, I was still taking the pain pills because, you know, I was hurting and everything, and I left with some pain pills. And shortly after that, I didn't want to be in any more pain, so I did get a few Suboxone off the streets. You know, after the miracle, witness the miracle, I was still, you know, and the guy said, I'm finna stop you again. My infection came right back, and this time it came back with a vengeance, is what I said. It was even worse than the last time. I was 3 months off of heart surgery, and I go back in there, and if it's going to have to have another one. I'm in a coma for 8 days, and I had I was so weak. They had just enough time. Where's the side view? One more. Where's the scars? Anyways, they went in on the side right here. All right. Well, they cut me open the first time. Second time, they went through the side, and there was so much scar tissue, and I was so weak. They only had time to remove my heart valve and to close it back up. And when I woke up, I had all the surgery. I was in a coma for 7 or 8 days, and waking up out of my, I was in this really, really the purest, whitest, cleanest room you could ever imagine. And I was laying on the middle of this like marble slab, it kind of felt like, and it was rotating. And a tall figure in the corner, I wish I could remember what he said. I just remember his hand went like that right there, and I went, and I popped wide open, and I was out of surgery. So I say that was my encounter with God, but I'm not sure what it was, but I want to believe that was him waking me up. So for this time, my rehab stint, I made sure they weaned me off pills. And I was not leaving that hospital on pills. And this is when I woke up praising God. And this is where I met God after this surgery. And this is where I told him that I'm going to live every day of my life for you now. And I'm going to spread my word. Spread what you've done for me. And that's when everything changed for me, is during that second surgery. And I left off pills. I've been free from clean for 5 years now. It's funny I'm speaking this right now, because it's actually this month is 5 years since my surgeries, and I've been seeing my memories come up on my phone and all the prayers I had. I had prayers from, where were they at? What's that? By the river? What's that river? Jordan River. Jordan River. I mean, they was all over the country. People in Arkansas, Texas. I mean, there was just prayers poured in for everywhere. And I needed every one of them. And I appreciate every one of them. So after that, I lived 4 years without a heart valve. And the doctors couldn't explain it. And I was, my blood pressure was perfect. My heart rate was perfect. I couldn't take off sprinting, but I could get around and do some normal things, you know. But, let me get here. All right. That's why I made these, keep me on track. All right. Within those 4 years, I got married to my beautiful wife, I've already introduced, and when I was on, I know you remember this, the second time, I thought I was dying, I said, all I ever wanted was a little boy. Remember that? And I'm going to die without having a little boy. Well, this is when I got married to my wife, and we got our little boy. So when we had our little boy, Cooper, I didn't tell you much about Ryder. He was born at 22 weeks. 24 weeks. He was born at 24 weeks. So, and Cooper has the same way. For some reason, my wife's uterus starts kicking the babies out at 17 weeks. She was only allowed to keep, she kept Cooper. I mean, she kept Ryder in there for 24 weeks, and then she had Cooper in there for 27, and that extra 3 weeks, huh? I'm real close. I'm really close. 26, 27. We've been married 4 or 5. This is the same thing, you know. So the extra 2 weeks made all the difference in the world. They told us he wouldn't catch up till he was in school because he would be behind. And he started playing t-ball when he was 3. He's supposed to wait till you're 4. What? Oh, he was 2 pounds when he was born. All that. So it was pretty cool. I mean, like, we went through the same thing, but this time we had God in our life and we was healthy and God knew we needed a kid at this point. We wasn't ready for one at the other point. So he went ahead and took him home with him. Oh, and in this time, I started a group called Bodybuilders. We wanted a meeting where you could freely talk about Jesus Christ and we could share our stories. That was our main goal. And we call it Redemption Night. It's much like this. It's altered. This is like altered. We started off with like maybe 10 or 15 people, and 7 of us was the ones trying to get it going. So, and we started off with a little bitty sandwich tray from Walmart, some off-brand oatmeal pies, and now 3 years later, we feed close to 100 people every time, and we have full course meals, a dessert bar, worship teams come, people come from all over to speak. It's really grown, and through that ministry, we found that people needed jobs and places to stay. And so I went to my pastor Kenny, and I said, we want to start this ministry, and we say we want to help people. I don't want to just say I want to help people. I want to be able to help people. So he said, I got your back, son. And so I was taking trash out one night, and there's this building, old abandoned building right above where we meet, and it's an old dentist's office. And the door was kind of, you could tell I could push it open, so I kind of just snuck in there and kind of, yeah, I trespassed and kind of walked through there. I was like, man, this is a lot of rooms. We could help a lot of people with this. And so I called my cousins, and my cousin that wouldn't give me a Diet Coke, and one of my lifelong friends, and told them about the place. They was like, well, find out who it is. They're investors. They're real estate investors now. So that's why I called them, and they said that find out whose it is and see what we can get it for. Talk to them. And I ended up researching whose it was, got in touch with them. And because of what we're doing, they gave us a real good deal on it. We was able to get the house going. And now we have anywhere from 18 to 20 men that we're helping. And I got one of my graduates back there. Cruz has made it through the program. Hey, Miss Cindy. How you doing? And then I got my other guys here that's been through the program. So and this is how I know God's in it, because he took a dumb old country boy that hadn't even read the Bible all the way through, that lived his last 17 years with the devil, and he saved me. He saw fit for me to save me on the operating table. Chills. It was all fit for me on the operating table to save me. And I hadn't given him any glory. I hadn't talked to him. I haven't been to his house of worship. I have done nothing for him for 17 years but doubt him. And he took me and started this ministry. And like I said, I hadn't read the Bible all the way through. The only verse I knew was John 3:16. I think if you're alive, you know that verse. So,
you come out of the womb, they start.
I mean, you know, that's the first one you know. So, why I tell you all that is, and then also in this 4 years, I started those two ministries. It's called Crossroads. And now I manage over 50 rental properties. I buy and sell real estate. I just put my second house under contract. I started a construction company to help these guys have places to work, a safe place to work. And I tell you all that, tell you that if I can do it, anybody can do it. Because I had absolutely nothing. I wasn't qualified. So, but I don't know, we've had over 150 people come through there, and I don't know, probably, I don't know the numbers, but probably 30 graduated or something like that over the past 2 years. And now we've been blessed with a church. It's a 7,000 square foot church that was donated to us that we're turning into a rehab or a discipleship program, and we're going to be able to house another 30 men. So now when an addict calls us from day one, we can send them to our rehab program, then we can send them to our sober living house, and we have the maintenance program with bodybuilders to help them through the rest of their life. So that's been my goal from the beginning. We got a lot of work to do on that house, and we are a nonprofit, so it's slowly being done. We've been working on it for over a year. But that's going to be great, because right now we're having to send them to these secular rehabs where they offer them the drug I hate the most, boxing and all that other crap. So, because right now they're coming to us, and they don't have any of our values, and we're just supposed to be a place to get them back on their feet and learn them how to live in society, teach them how to live in society, but we're having to teach them, start all over with them once they get there. So that was our goal. And so now, just last year, I knew when I had my heart valve out, I knew I was going to have another surgery, but I was going to eventually have to have another surgery because, like, I did the research, and the longest person that I found that lived without a heart valve was, what, 2 or 3 years? And I was on year number 4, so I knew I had to hurry up and get things done because I'm starting to carry a lot of fluid and starting to get out of breath real soon, real bad. But I was we was going to the one in Baptist, and I kept going, meeting these different surgeons, and it's like 2 or 3 different ones. I was like, nah, that ain't the one. I finally was like, let's go to, someone's telling me to go to UAB. And I went to UAB, and it was this old rude doctor with cowboy boots on, and he just pretty much told me that, you know, you ain't got much chance to live. You know, this will be the third time you had it. I mean, everything you could, bad news you could get, you know, you got this. I think I had, what, 20% chance to live or something to make it like that. He was throwing all these things. I was like, gosh, doc, you know, you could at least break it to me easy. But anyways, but when I left there, I was like, that's the guy. And I don't really know what else. I said, I'm going to go ahead and call him and schedule this surgery right now because I got to have it, you know. And that's how I know God was in the story, because when I had surgery, the surgery went fine this time. I came out and I got a pig valve, so everybody was making little oink-oink jokes, and we were laughing and cutting up, having a good time. And all of a sudden, like the second night, my mask, I couldn't breathe good. And I kept adjusting my mask, and I thought, I mean, I'm fat now, but I was real fat at that point. I was about 20 more pounds heavier, so I had a big old fat face, and I couldn't get I thought it was a mask that I couldn't get on. I couldn't breathe, and I kept telling them, and they kept adjusting the mask, and they finally told me they don't have to, incubate me? And I said, you're going to stick that thing down my throat, you're putting me to sleep, I cannot handle it. So they put me to sleep, and I thought it was just, we couldn't get a mask, you know, and then I wake up 2 days later, and I got this big old red tube with my blood coming out of my neck and out of my groin, and it's called the ECMO machine, and it pretty much breathes for me. And because this, I was on the life support and still dying. Like, I was dying. Like, the life support. And this right here, this is why I tell you guys in the story, because I picked this guy, this rude doctor from UAB that told me every bad thing it could be. And there's only a handful of hospitals in the whole nation that even have this machine. If I was at the Memphis one, I would have died, because this is the only thing that kept me alive. So without even knowing I needed the ECMO machine, yeah, that's how I woke up right there. It was not a good day. Anyways, I thought I was on this alien spaceship. I mean, it was crazy. And I kept hearing, like, I guess everything was in a loop. Like, the nurse would come in there and tell me something. I'd be like, you just told me that. And then they're like, no, I didn't. And anyways, It was weird. I was playing my. This was a really rough time for me. That's my blood coming, getting taken out of my body, getting put back in down in my hip, or taken out of my hip, being put back in right there. It goes to this machine and oxygenates it and makes it good blood and pumps it back in there. So anyway, then I was on this. I coughed. The cough about took me out. I told them. I said, y'all finna do something for me. I couldn't sleep for 3 days. I couldn't do nothing. And the cough. And I just had open heart surgery. And the cough, pain was horrendous. And I told them, I about give up. I'm about to tap out. And to get out of ICU, I had to get out the feeding tube. And I had to be able to walk. But I couldn't. I wasn't healing. I was still not as gross. I was using the bathroom on myself. I couldn't control my valves. I was sitting there just like that right there. Couldn't do nothing. And I told him to give me some drugs. I want some clobazepam or something to knock me out. I'm done. I ain't trying to fight it no more. Give me something to knock me out. And this doctor, one of the doctors, came to us before, and he's the one that put me on the, it made the choice to put me on life support and ECMO. And he said, I know y'all are believers. I know some of these doctors ain't in here, but you just know I'm praying for you. And he came in there when I was yelling for drugs. And he said, you got to keep your faith. You can't be scared to die. We know where we're going as Christians and all this kind of stuff. So he kind of ministered to me and calmed me down. And he said, if we're not better in the morning, that I'll give you some medicine or whatever. That night he left, after he prayed for me and ministered to me, I had the best night of sleep I had since I'd been there. Cough was gone. To get home, I had to go to this next stage and stay there for 2 weeks before I could even come home. This happened on a Friday night, and that Wednesday I was going home. So, and that's, you know, that's how I know that God's in this entire story. You know, He's been with me every my whole life. I just didn't know it. But anyways, that's who I live for now. Our relationship's so much better now. Before, when we was in addiction, it was lies and cheats. And now that we're living for God and put God first, we're able to have a beautiful marriage. So it can be done. I'm gonna end the story with this verse. It's 1 Peter. But you are chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of the darkness and into His wonderful light.